Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Forgive me the opportunity to participate in this conference. Well, my paper begins with an intriguing relation between the two poles which underpin my reflection, that is the just war, bellum justum, on the one hand, and the criminal law of the enemy, or fein Strafrecht in German, on the other. This intriguing relation can be defined as specular, for one mirrors the other. The just war transforms the enemy into a kind of citizen which can be submitted to trial, implying that there is a common law which is binding beyond the frontiers of every state. On the other side, the fein Strafrecht, the enemy criminal law, transforms the city into a kind of enemy who is not to be protected by the same law as the rest of the citizens. We may start with the ideology of the just and righteous war, bellum justum piunque. Firstly, I will comment shortly on what this bellum justum was not. And secondly, I will focus on how we get an idea of what it was by analyzing Cicero's version of it. In the negative part of my argument, bellum justum was not reduced to a question of using the right procedure when declaring war, the so-called jus fetiale. This is a serious misunderstanding of the role of the fetialis, an archaic college of priests who were involved in the rituals associated with declaring a war but had no power to decide it. In short, these fetiales, as other Roman priests, were experts who knew the rituals, the prescribed words, and were consulted by the Senate on these issues. But the decision was in the hands of the Senate or the people. They decided whether the war was just or unjust, not basing their decision on whether the rituals had been rightly performed, but on moral issues. So the question poses itself. If a just war cannot be defined as the war which has been ritually and solemnly declared by the fetiales, how can we define it? In order to have an answer to this question, we should now take a look at Cicero's writings, namely two of his works in which he devoted some reflections on this topic, on the commonwealth and on duties. Three important ideas can be highlighted in the Ciceronian argument. Firstly, a war can be deemed just when started not only for defensive reasons, but also for glory. Cicero is quite explicit on this. When the survival of the city is at stake, it is a cruel and fierce war. When the war is a fight for command and glory, then it is of a less brutal kind. Nevertheless, both types must have been entered upon with the same intention, namely that of living peacefully without suffering any harms. This does not amount to a blank admission of any kind of war as just, because it is the intention that matters. If the war was prompted by avarice, then it cannot be deemed just. In a world like Cicero's, where conflicts were permanent, the distinction between defensive and aggressive war probably was not so clear-cut. Secondly, Cicero does not focus exclusively on the road to war. Using modern parlance, he also takes into account the jus in bello and the jus post bellum. What he has to say of the jus in bello is neither extensive nor original, but he clearly states the rule that only proper soldiers can fight. Those who had been dismissed by their general are not allowed to engage in combat. As to the jus post bellum, it is noteworthy that it does not appear, for example, in the list of requirements for a just war according to St. Thomas of Aquinas. Cicero thought otherwise. For him, it was of paramount importance. Unless the enemy's behavior during the combats had been extremely brutal and savage, the obligation of the conqueror was to preserve the vanquished. This does not mean that Rome abstained from taking advantage of her victories. We know many cases of brutality, enemies who were killed by thousands without remorse. the important thing was not the people, but the city. This should be preserved and not annihilated. Cicero had a very good argument on his side, namely Roman generosity granting her citizenship to others. Rome's record concerning the jus post bellum is clearly outstanding when compared to other empires in world history. Thirdly, the subject of the just war was very important to him. Cicero built his most important dialogue on the Commonwealth upon the idea that the Commonwealth, the res publica, was defined by justice. Unjust Commonwealths were not truly republics. Therefore, he had to prove that Rome had conquered her empire with no injustice on her side. Otherwise, Rome could not be conceived of as the ideal regime Cicero wanted to portray. Now we have come to the second part of this intriguing relation, the one that revolves around the state of exception. The very famous first sentence of Carl Smith's Political Theology reads, "Sovereign is he who decides on the exception." The eighth thesis on the philosophy of history, written in 1940 by Walter Benjamin, contains an explicit reference to this Smithian idea. And lastly, in 2003, Giorgio Agamben devoted a small book to this state of exception. According to Smith, the state of exception implies a suspension of the entire existing juridical order. Agamben underscores the uncertain and paradoxical character of the resulting condition. The state of exception presents itself as an inherently elusive phenomenon, a juridical no man's land where the law is suspended in order to be preserved. The state of exception, as conceptualized first by Smith in 1922 and then by Benjamin in 1940, has again come to the forefront as a direct consequence of 9/11 attacks. As Agamben points out, and I quote, "The state of exception has today reached its maximum worldwide deployment. The normative aspect of law can thus be obliterated and contradicted with impunity by a governmental violence that, while ignoring international law externally and producing a permanent state of exception internally, nevertheless still claims to be applying the law." And the states of exception in Rome, when one takes even a cursory look at the several states of exception measures of the Roman Constitution, what surely strikes most is their sheer number, their abundance. First, we have the dictatorship, which fell out of use after the Second Punic War and was later reintroduced by Sulla and Caesar, but changing its nature, for the 6 months limit was overruled. Mark Antony then passed a law abolishing the dictatorship altogether, and as it is well known, Augustus, the first emperor, did not need dictatorship to claim sole power. The next three, that is the so-called Senatus Consultum Ultimum, the ultimate decree, and the Hostis Erclarum, who has been declared as public enemy under Tumultus, are best seen together, for they constituted the panoply that was at the Senate's disposal to fight against any attempt at regime change. Scholars have discussed at length this Senatus Consultum Ultimum, this ultimate decree. They have debated on its legality and they have come to very different, even contradictory conclusions. For some, it had no legal meaning, it carried only a political message, but it did not confer new capacities or legal powers to the magistrates involved. The truth is that the actual words of the senatorial decree were laconic. Even if there are variants in the sources, we may be confident that this so-called ultimate decree was always very short, just one sentence: that the consuls and the proconsuls that were near Rome should take care that the Commonwealth receive no detriment. It is true that this ultimate decree identified neither the additional powers at the magistrate's disposal nor the citizen rights which might be overridden for reasons of state. The decree did not set any time frame, nor do we ever hear of a senatorial decision declaring that this state of emergency was over and things had gone back to normal. No specific measure seems here to be contemplated. In particular, there is no mention of the right to kill Roman citizens without trial. Modern scholars tend to think that the consuls could legally take all those measures without needing any special authorization by the Senate. This is hard to believe. We have evidence that the ultimate decree, at least by implication, gave the right to command troops inside the city. Probably Mommsen was about right in saying that this ultimate decree established in Rome the law of war, even if it was not automatically followed by a tumultus, as Mommsen thought. The decree was a direct response to conflicts or rebellions in the city of Rome, the urbs, not Italy or the provinces. It revolves around the idea of preserving the public order in the city of Rome, a sacred precinct where the military power was not valid. The actual words of the text are not the only thing that matters. We know also what happened after the Senate passed the decree. What our sources tell us amounts to a proper state of emergency. It was not only the killing of hundreds or even thousands of Roman citizens on the spot, without trial. Their goods were confiscated, their houses razed to the ground, and their bodies thrown into the Tiber River. Special trials were conducted against the friends of the agitators. Prosecution tried to eradicate even the memory of their deeds. The chiefing of the plebs, for example, was sentenced to exile a year later for the only reason of having at home a statue of a violent tribune who had been killed 2 years before. At the end of the day, it is difficult not to accept that this ultimate decree was very successful. In the 8 different moments when the Senate retorted to this measure, several thousand Roman citizens, including 2 tribunes of the plebs, were killed without a trial, and no one was ever condemned for these crimes, with the only debatable exception of Cicero himself. And debatable it is, for he went to exile in order to avoid standing trial. In its blurry figure, the ultimate decree fits perfectly well into the state of emergency as conceived of by Agamben. This has been taken by Andreas Kalibas as proof that, contrary to the conventional wisdom, a mixed constitution, such as Rome, was less stable, not more, than a democracy, for Athens had no use of the emergency measures. And I quote, "Whereas democratic Athens banned the tyrannical form of power in the name of freedom, the Roman Republic legalized it in the name of liberty. What was excluded from the constitutional arrangement of Athens was fully included in the mixed regime of Rome." End of quote. This is not completely accurate. Ostracism was clearly an emergency measure incorporated in the Athenian constitution. Yet, Kalligas has correctly emphasized the paradox of a constitution which repeatedly needed to invoke emergency measures to avoid being overthrown. The reason is clear. Sovereignty had no stable location in the Roman Republic, and we will come back to this at the end of the paper. Cicero addressed the subject of the state of exception several times in his works, but now I will focus solely on 2 of them, the speeches against Catiline and the Philippics. Against Catiline, Cicero delivered the first of his famous Catilinarian speeches when Catiline was sitting in the Senate. An ultimate decree had been passed, but Cicero, as consul, wanted to have complete and unequivocal evidence before taking harsh measures against him. Still, he stated very clearly his position. The laws protecting citizens do not benefit those who have deserted the Republic, and this has always been so in the history of Rome. The day after, Catiline has already flown away and Cicero is speaking in front of the people. "We are conducting a just war against an enemy," he says. Cicero threatens with severe punishment those friends and allies of Catiline who remain in the city. He considers them to be hostes, public enemies, and even if they were Roman citizens. In his third speech, Cicero says, "These conspirators wanted to destroy the city and all its inhabitants and announced to the people that by a decision of the Senate, one of the leaders had forfeited his condition as citizen." but it is in the fourth speech where we find the clearest expression of Cicero's thought in this issue. He very specifically refers to the Sempronian law, according to which only the people could pass a capital sentence against a Roman citizen. Again, Cicero says, those who are public enemies of the Republic are not citizens. They are not just criminal citizens, but they are the most cruel enemies. They are worse than foreign enemies. Those madmen who have decided to become enemies of their country cannot be compelled by force nor gained with benefits. This is the reason why war against them is eternal. We cannot be sure, but it is probably now, in this particular context, when Cicero invented this new theory, namely that a citizen who was guilty of treason forfeited his rights of citizenship retrospectively to the time when his crime was committed, and could therefore be summarily dealt without trial. This idea was later accepted by some jurists in the Severan period. In the Severian period, Paulus, for example, pointed out that those who had been declared public enemies by the Senate or a law forfeited their Roman citizenship. Well, Philippics, the speeches against Mark Antony, was Cicero's last stand for republicanism with mixed results. They gave the orator fame and glory, but also provided justification for his murder during the subsequent proscription. In his long tirade against the consul, Mark Antony, Cicero knew no bounds. The acts of open rebellion by the future Emperor Augustus were justified by the orator in the name of the Republic. Even if Brutus, the tyrant slayer, warned him against giving too much power and honors to the young and ambitious heir of Caesar, Cicero paid no heed to his advice. He was true to his ideas. Against the tyrant, and he had no doubts Mark Antony was aiming at tyranny, every response, every form of resistance is permitted. And now, the enemy criminal law, the fine Strafrecht, was devised as an ideal type, by the German professor Gunther Jacobs for the first time in 1985. This ideal type became a really hot issue after the war on Iraq and the debates about enemy combatants incarcerated without accusation or trial in Guantanamo. Jacobs' proposal amounts to the creation of a new type of criminal law, which is governed by three principles. First, punishment comes well before an actual harm occurs. Second, it contains disproportionate, extremely high imprisonment sanctions. Third, it suppresses procedural rights. There has been some inquiry into the origins of this enemy criminal law. While Jacobs himself has claimed there is no connection with the notorious concept of enemy by Carl Schmitt, other more palatable names such as Hobbes and Kant are usually mentioned by him or his followers. In my opinion, the link between Jacobs and Smith's theories is strong, but we have no time to show it. Our interest lies in the connection with Cicero. As far as I know, the ancient roots of this ideal type have never been explored, yet they are very visible to the observer. In ancient Roman law, citizens were protected by the right to provocatio, which meant that they could not be put to death unless by the assembly or a jury of citizens. Cicero argued that he who has conspired against the Republic has voluntarily forfeited his citizenship and could be dealt with accordingly, that is, as an enemy of Rome. His justification was almost the same as the one Jacobs provided. The state, the Republic in Cicero, has the right to protect itself in order to avoid being destroyed, what Jacobs encapsulates as the right, as the so-called right to security, Grundrecht auf Sicherheit. One last point. Who is a public enemy? Who is an hostis? The answer must be, in Cicero, the tyrant, for tyrants do not belong to human society. Anybody can kill them without suffering any penalty. Cicero has a very specific word for them, which purports to reveal their true nature. Furiosi, contrary to other mental illness such as dementia or stupidity, furor can also affect the wise man. This is not an inborn illness. Very able men, excellent orators and statesmen, for different reasons became frenzied, mad, and wild men, furiosi. It is one of Cicero's favorite insults. He uses it very many times. He applies the insult to each and every popular leader of recent history. But there is more to it. Furiosus, as Cicero himself said, translates the Greek melancholia, or black humor, which is the psychological feature of the tyrant. When Cicero calls his political rivals furiosi, he's insulting them for aspiring to tyranny. They are criminals not for what they have done, but because their psychological conditions or personal liabilities, an enormous amount of debt, horrifying crimes, impel them to destroy the political community. We may find some connection with a purportedly vague notion of enemy in Jacob's theory. Enemy is understood as someone who, to a not merely incidental extent in his attitude or his occupational life or by his inclusion in an organization, has at any rate presumably permanently turned away from the law, and in this respect does not guarantee the minimum cognitive security of personal behavior and demonstrates this deficit by his behavior. In both cases, Cicero and Jacobs, it is the moral personal behavior of the enemy that counts, which places him permanently outside the law. Punishment has to change its objective accordingly. It is no more the cure of the convicted. Crimes are no longer seen as remedial diseases. At most, punishment may serve as a warning to other criminals who may then change their behavior. Soon, Cicero convinced himself that this was pointless. Their minds cannot be cured or changed. His enmity with Catilinarians was a perpetual war, an eternal war, aeternum bellum. So, to conclude, the specular relation between the bellum justum and the state of exception suggests that the modern development of the international criminal law goes hand in hand with increasing acceptance of a state of exception measures. In the end, both developments are responding to the radical erosion of the notion of sovereignty. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.